Hi, I'm Brooke Taylor, the pastor of Missio Church. We exist to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ without having to come or go anywhere. Thank you so much for listening to our sermon series through the Old Testament book of Job. We are so excited about what God is teaching us about Himself, about our suffering, and about Jesus Christ through His Word. It is the prayer of the elders of Missio Church that listening to this sermon would help transform you into the image of Jesus Christ and deepen your relationship with Him. We desire that this sermon would be a supplement to your regular engagement with a local church and would not in any way replace you gathering with that church and submitting to the leaders that God has put over your life. If the elders of Missio Church can be of any assistance to you, you can contact us through our website, www.missiochurch.faith. You can also email us at admin@missiochurch.faith or by calling us 631-241-2136. If you are not a part of a local church, you can gather with us each Sunday at 10 a.m. at 70 Smith Road in Ridge, New York. We hope you enjoy today's message. You know, I was so excited when my girls were younger to introduce them to the Star Wars series. We would watch the film, and you know, if you remember this, the first time you watched, the 21st Century Fox logo would appear, and the lion would growl, and the screen would display those words a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and then everything would fade to black. And there was kind of this sense of anticipation, like what's going to happen next. And then with the crash of cymbals, the Star Wars logo would come on the screen and the music would start playing and my girls would just scream at the top of their lungs. But then a bunch of yellow text starts to scroll across the screen. And it talks about an evil empire and a civil war that's going on and a most recent spy activity that had taken place to help these rebels to defeat this evil empire. And for a movie that is praised for its cinematography and special effects, its introduction, this scrolling text, is frankly a little archaic and very uninteresting. Might be why my wife has never watched more than 5 minutes of Star Wars. But the text is so necessary to set up the story of the film, because once the film begins, it just drops you into this already ongoing saga. And Job kind of begins in the similar kind of way. Verses 1 to 5 is this very uninteresting introduction. We meet Job, we hear his weekly routine, and nothing happens. It just sets the scene. But then verse 6 opens up, and it drops you into an already existing drama. In fact, if you didn't have verses 1 to 5, you wouldn't fully appreciate and understand what happens when verse 6 opens. Bypassing these opening verses would be a mistake. It might lead you to make wrong conclusions about Job, just like his friends do. Now, Job is a very recognizable name to almost anyone. He transcends both Christian and non-Christian circles. His name is synonymous with unparalleled suffering. And it would not be unusual to hear someone talk about their Job-like suffering, finding commonality with his experience, or maybe finding hope from his story and how it ends for their future. I mean, we can all relate to suffering. Right? Our world is filled with tragedy and decay, disease, oppression, natural disasters, unnatural disasters, terrorists, betrayal, chronic pain, loneliness, emptiness, death, and mourning. And so it's easy to see why Job resonates with people of all backgrounds, both religious and not religious. Most people are well aware of Job's suffering in chapters 1 and 2. Less know of his restoration in chapter 42. And few people know Job's full anthology in the remaining or middle 39 chapters. One reason is that Job is a very difficult book to understand. Some of the questions that we face in Job are, why does God allow Job to suffer such tragedy? Why does God allow anybody to suffer tragedy? Why do his friends offer such bad advice and even blame Job for his own suffering? Why does God's treatment of Job seem to be unjust? And why on earth does describing this behemoth and leviathan have anything to do with suffering at all? Why does Satan have access to God's presence? Why does God seem indifferent to Job's suffering? And is God the author of evil? Those are just a few of the questions that we will face or that might pop up in our minds. And by the end of Job, many of those questions will remain unanswered. Another reason that people don't often understand Job or know much about Job is because Job is long. We live in a culture of sound bites and drive-throughs. We like short stories resolved in 30 minutes. And Job has 42 chapters. So who has the patience or the time to read 42 chapters? Like, we would prefer a Reader's Digest version, like the Cliff Notes, something to just sort of get us the gist of the story and the gist of the ending so that we can move on to something else. But the length of Job reveals the weightiness of suffering. See, there are no easy answers to suffering. There are no tidy propositions or catchphrases or pithy slogans or bullet points for suffering. Our questions about suffering cannot be resolved in a text message. It takes time. And 42 chapters is a lot of time to let the story simmer, where we can wrestle with our own emotions and our own wills and our own sensitivities. It's a long journey not to find easy answers that we want to hear, but hard answers that we need to hear. Job is part of the Old Testament Ketuvim, which includes the five scrolls, the Song of Solomon, Ruth, Esther, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Chronicles, and it includes what we call wisdom literature, Psalms, Proverbs, and Job. Job begins and ends with narrative, but most of Job is Hebrew poetry. And poetry is not merely meant to be read from the head, it's meant to be read from the heart. And we don't typically interpret poetry literally. I mean, we might find some hidden meaning in the poem, but generally, the beauty of poetry is left to the eye of the beholder. And events in poetry don't need to be real. Biblical poetry, though, is a little bit different than the poetry that we learn maybe in 11th grade English. Poetry in the Bible is used in relation to historical events. For instance, Exodus chapter 14 is a narrative story, and Exodus 15 is the poetic version of the same story. Both are historically true, and both describe the same literal event. The same is true for Judges chapter 4 and chapter 5. Now, in the book of Proverbs, it teaches the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and that generally speaking, when people live wisely, good things will come to them. And though Job is part of that wisdom literature of Proverbs, and it does affirm where true wisdom is found, Job does not read with all those proverbial platitudes. It has more in common with Ecclesiastes, whose conclusion is all of life is a vapor, all of life is a mist. Eric Ortlund says that Job is intentionally designed to tire and frustrate the reader, but there is no other way to access the joy and comfort that Job receives at the end of his ordeal except to journey along with him through each of the book's long chapters. We will spend several months digging into each chapter, sometimes slowly and intently, letting it percolate in our hearts and minds, and other times a little bit more briskly. But the goal is to discover, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. Because there is so much more to the story than just his suffering. But before we get into the most famous or well-known parts of Job, we get to begin with an introduction, to dip our toes into the water, to set the stage for the story, and to prepare ourselves by God's grace for all that we will come to hear and apply to our own lives and discover ultimately how everything in Job points to one who is greater than Job. It points to Jesus. In chapters 1 and 2, there are 5 different scenes that take place. And they alternate between earth and heaven, earth and heaven, and earth. And the first scene is here in verses 1 to 5. And there are 4 things that I want you to see this morning about Job. And the first is that Job is a real man. He's a real man. Because 95% of Job is poetry, and because it's difficult to read, and because the story almost seems outlandish, we can tend to think that Job is mythical, like John Bunyan or Johnny Appleseed. That it's a made-up story, and it teaches moral lessons, but it's not real. And there are other ancient mythical stories with similar experiences to Job. They're not identical to Job, but they're similar. And so it leads us to think that the Bible just copied the mythical stories of other religious groups, other nationalities. And this isn't all that surprising because we see similar patterns in various creation and flood stories that exist in other religions and other cultures. But C.S. Lewis offers this very helpful analysis of myths. He says that there is both myth and true myth. And the difference is that all other myth is a shadow of the true myth. All myth is an attempt to shine light on the truth, on the ultimate truth. All myth conveys truth through storytelling, but true myth is not just another story. It is the story. It is reality. And what C.S. Lewis is trying to say is that myths are often based on historical reality. That other groups have a mythical figure similar to Job does not hurt Job's historicity. It actually gives it more credence. And I understand the temptation of some to see Job as myth. But when we strip events and figures in the Bible of their historicity, if they are just fairy tales, then they offer no real hope or comfort. They offer no more hope or comfort than getting our advice from Princess Elsa or Princess Buttercup. If Job is merely fiction, then what difference does it make that he suffered? It's make-believe. What difference does it make why he suffered? It wasn't real. What difference does it make of what came of his suffering? Because he doesn't exist. And how can it have any meaning for us? Job is not a myth. It's not a fable. He's a real man. Now, there is no clear historical setting in Job. It is hard to know when Job actually took place because there is no point of reference. There's no comment on some historical event or natural disaster. But based on the language that's used and the practices that are described, most scholars would conclude that Job lived near the time of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob, about 1900 BC or so, long before the Exodus. The author of the story of Job and the date that it was written is also unknown. It's anonymous. It's not an autobiography. Job did not write his own story. But it is clear that the author is well-versed not only in the Hebrew way of life, but in the Hebrew scriptures, especially wisdom literature, often alluding to or even quoting lines directly from Proverbs or Deuteronomy. The author, we know, was inspired by God to retell events he certainly did not see. The author didn't get a chance to peer into the heavenly courtroom of God. The author was also well-traveled. I mean, this author knows of constellations and meteorology, mining, ostriches, eagles, goats, hippopotamuses, crocodiles, war horses. He knows Near Eastern myth stories and other extra-biblical content. The human author is quite brilliant. And we would assume the human author is probably an Israelite. But his identity remains a mystery. Some have said that Job was written during Israel's exile in 586 BC to encourage Israel during their time of suffering. And though this is plausible, it would seem unlikely because Ezekiel in chapter 14, long before the exile, speaks specifically of Job and his story, which suggests that his story was well known or maybe even written decades before Ezekiel. And so most scholars would say that Job was either written during the time of Moses, about 1500 BC, during Solomon's reign, about 900 BC, or during Ezekiel's prophetic ministry. There is no consensus. There is also evidence in the text that Job knew not just some generic God, that he knew the God of Abraham. He knew Yahweh. The name Yahweh is used by Job multiple times, not just simply the generic word for God. It says in verse 1 that Job is from Uz, and the precise location of Uz is unknown. It seems to be a city related to Edom, a descendant of Shem from Genesis 10, and the land of Esau's family in Genesis 36. Uz, to the best of our understanding, is located east of the Jordan River and south of the Dead Sea, which makes it outside of the nation of Israel proper and closer to the Red Sea and the Sinai Peninsula. Job is not an Israelite, and neither are any of his friends. Though perhaps the best counselor in the story appears to be, by his name, having a very significant Jewish root. Job's name could mean enemy, as though he is one who is being treated as an enemy by God. Or his name could be a shortened form of "Where is my father?" which would also seem appropriate since Job wonders where God is during all of his difficulty. But by the end of the story, both meanings prove to be untrue, at least for Job's life. Job is not God's enemy, and Job has not been abandoned by God. Job is mentioned only briefly in the Old and New Testaments. But in both instances, Job is treated as a real man with real flesh and blood, with real feelings, with real struggles, with real heartache, with real patience. Job is someone like us. Job is real. Job is a real man. But it's not just the historicity of Job that stands out. Job's character is also evident in these opening verses. Job is not just a real man. Job is a righteous man. The second half of verse 1 describes Job in terms that the Bible uses almost exclusively for significant figures in the Bible, like Noah and Abraham. It says that Job is blameless. Now, blameless does not mean perfect or sinless as we might think. It's related to personal integrity, that there is no record against Job, that he has a heart of genuine reverence for God. Job is a sinner, and we will see this as we go through in chapters 13 and chapter 14. But when Job sins, Job confesses his sin and seeks out atonement from God for his sin. Job has a pious faith, and his public persona and his private devotion are the same. He is no hypocrite. He is someone who loves God and whose life honors God. But not only is he blameless, he is also upright. He is ethically and morally straight, a person of integrity, above reproach in all his dealings. He treats those around him in a just and good way, living according to God's standards. He is well respected by those who know him and those who don't know him well. In chapter 31, Job describes himself as one who is faithful to his wife, attentive to the needs of others, generous to the poor, gracious to the widow. He feeds the hungry, he clothes the needy, and he adopts orphans. I mean, Job is the kind of man that we would want as a boss or a neighbor or a spouse for our daughter and certainly for president. And the text says that Job feared God. You see, Job was aware that God was watching. He was aware that he would give an account to God. And Job's description here fits the description of wisdom in the book of Proverbs. Job knows the Creator. Job trusts the Creator's promises. Job believes in a powerful, good, and sovereign God who's worthy of his worship. And Job does not walk in the way of evil. He hates evil. He turns away from it. And when he sins, repentance is the pattern of his life. One might say that Job loves God with all of his heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loves his neighbor as himself. Or maybe Micah 6:8 would describe Job. Oh man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? One author says of Job, Job is in his land what Adam was meant to be on the whole earth. In a way, Job is kind of like another Adam, a holy man who lives for God, who reveals the marks of a true believer. And I think it's fair to say that Job is declared righteous by faith, faith in God, faith in his promises. And you might say, well, this is a really interesting assessment of Job. Does he think of himself like this? Does someone else think of this, of himself like this? But what we learn at the end of chapter 1 is that God sees Job this way. This is God's description. Job was a righteous man. But thirdly, we see in verses 2 to 4 that Job was a rich man. It is clear that Job is prosperous in every measurable way. There was a mythical king of Phrygia in Asia Minor who was famous for an extraordinary ability to change everything he touched into gold. I think the muffler company has borrowed his name, the Midas touch. And Job kind of brings that to mind, embodying Proverbs 22:4, the reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. And Job is rich. The first thing we see is he's rich in family. He had children born to him. They were born to him. They were not achieved by him. You see, blessings or rewards of God are not wages. They are not something you earn. And he had 7 sons and 3 daughters that were given to him by God. And his family seems to love each other. The description in chapter 1 is that they celebrated together what seems like every day. A feast in the house of each son. Eating and celebrating and drinking. You know, this has become a lost attribute of families in the church. So often, meals are done in a rush. Meals are done in front of the TV. Meals are done in solitary confinement in your bedroom. And I think one of the things we learn here, fathers and husbands, is that we should cultivate the practice of eating with our family together at a table with the TV turned off and the cell phones put away. Maybe break out the fine china that you haven't used since your wedding night. Or use paper plates if that's more of your speed. You know, most nights, even if I have somewhere else to be later in the evening or a meeting, Marlena, Gabriel, David, Faith, and whoever else might be in our house at that particular moment, today it's Audrey, we will sit down together for dinner. And based on schedules, that time changes. Sometimes it's 6 o'clock. But sometimes if I have someplace to be, it's 4:30 or 5:15. But there is something important, I think, something eternal, something divine and heavenly about a family that feasts around a table together. As we sung earlier, you might be teaching your children more about God and His family by sharing a meal together than anything else you could say about Him. Job's family is constantly throwing parties. And while lavish living and gratuitous celebrations are often associated in Scripture with sinful gluttony, what this family is doing here doesn't seem to be criticized. If there are sinful choices going on, it is not being highlighted. That is not the justification for why Job suffers. Oh, your children through lavish parties. These festal gatherings seem to be good and appropriate. A family that is eating together and staying together. It's interesting that none of Job's daughters have husbands that are mentioned, which suggests two things. One, that those daughters were probably unmarried. And two, that Job is not as old as we tend to think that he is. We think of Job as like some really old man with a long beard near the end of his life. But it seems like that Job is probably in the middle of his life, at the height of his youthfulness. And God's blessed him with children. And this is the first blessing listed, and I don't think that's by surprise or unintentional. You see, wealth, real estate, or fame, those are not the most important things to Job. His family is. And it's evident by how much he cares for them. Job is also rich in wealth. That's obvious too. You can't get past the houses and the flocks and the too many servants to count. I mean, his animals that he possesses covers all areas of economic activity, herding, trade, harvest. And one would think that by all indications, Job has not just amassed this wealth. It wasn't handed down to him from a father. He's a hard worker. Some people might see the prosperity gospel in this text and say, well, see, it's true. If you just love God, God will give you whatever you want. If you just obey God, God will give you riches. But I don't think that that's why Job has these things. I don't think that's his motivation in obeying God. But he was wealthy. He was rich. Job is also rich in fame. It says that he was the greatest of all the peoples of the East. I don't think that's a hyperbole. I think everybody knew him. Everybody respected him. There is no one in the world like Job. What an amazing description. The greatest of all the peoples. Job is known for his wealth. He's known for his character. He's known for his attributes. He's known for his family. It does not appear that Job seeks out any of these things. This is not what he lived for. He lived for God. At the center of his life was God. The focus of his life was the righteousness that God desired. And the blessings seemed to be immaterial. I think of Job, Matthew 6:31 comes to mind. Seek first the kingdom of heaven and His righteousness. And all these things will be added to you. And what are the things in verse 31? What do we eat? What will we drink? What will we wear? God will give you what you need. Job appears to have everything ordered correctly in his life. He is seeking God. He is seeking righteousness. And God responds to his humble faithfulness and love, not only by giving him spiritual relationship with himself, but by being generous. Job is a rich man. And lastly, Job is a religious man. I know we tend to see religion as evil. Followers of Jesus will often say, Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. And it's easy to cite how often Jesus criticizes the religious leaders in Israel. So anytime we hear something that we don't like, we say, well, that's just religious. That's just religion. I heard one author say that religion cultivated or guarded Job's relationship with God. Because one guards what they treasure, they tend to want what they love. Job loved God. And his religion guarded what he loved most. So he prayed and he obeyed and he sacrificed and he fasted, and not so he could have more stuff, but so he could have more of God. That was the motivation of his religious practice. Job's religious goal was not religion. Job's religious goal was not wealth. Job's religious goal was God. And it was set by God. Job lived in the time before Moses and before the monarchy. And during the monarchy, during the time of Moses, what Job does is forbidden. You don't just simply go and offer sacrifices like this on your own. You don't go build your own altar. You are not your own priest. There's the Levitical system. There's the law of Moses. Everything functions within that. So it's clear that what Job is doing is long before the law has been given. He is coming to God as God has revealed himself to him. Just like Cain and Abel came to God, in one case, how God revealed himself to be, and in the case of Cain, how he wanted to come. Abel was accepted, Cain was not. Job was accepted because he comes to God the way that God permitted him to. And what's interesting is that Job would offer sacrifices for himself and for his children just in case they had sinned. You see, Job has an eagerness, not just for his own spiritual life. He has an eagerness for the spiritual life of his children and those he knows. He is conscious, so conscious of sin in their lives too. What if they have sinned? What if they have cursed God? What if they stand before a holy God tomorrow? And too often, as Christian fathers, we often care about the wrong things. We care too much that our children might embarrass us as toddlers or teenagers. We care too much that they would find us cool or trendy. We care too much if they have boyfriends or girlfriends in middle school. We care too much if they get straight A's in high school or go to the right college. I mean, let's be honest, parents. Some of us are more concerned that our children make six figures and don't live in a trailer park than if they are greedy, lying, no good son of guns who have sex outside of marriage. It would embarrass us more if our children needed food stamps than if they had children out of wedlock. Our priorities are out of whack. But Job, he cares about the personal and spiritual lives of his adult children. He's the kind of father who corrects their sin and rebukes their foolishness and calls out lawlessness and prays for his children. Not just for his young children. These are adult children. They have their own lives and their own families and their own homes, and he is still concerned about their spiritual lives. He acts like a king and a priest for his own family. Now, we can't offer sacrifices for our children any more than we can have faith for our children. Each person must decide for themselves to believe God's word by faith and have it counted to them as righteousness. But Job prioritized his own walk with God. He understood there is something dark in the human heart. He is conscientious of his sin and his children's sin. He is conscientious of God's justice for sin, and he believed in the power of atoning sacrifice. We are often anxious about frivolous things. Traffic on the LIE, what someone might say about us, what we will eat for dinner. But Job is anxious in his heart about sin, and he is anxious in his heart about his children's sin and whether or not they believe God and it was counted to them as righteousness too. Job did this continually. Job is a religious man, and I wonder if that's true of us. You know, what we see here is breathtaking. Job is a real, righteous, rich, religious man. And those are fundamental things to all that follows in the story. And we will discover that Job's friends misjudge him, and Satan misjudges him, and even we can misjudge him. Job worshiped God every day when all was well in his life, when blessing abounded, when family and wealth were at his peak. Job was righteous and humble and loving and devoted to God. But the lesson that we take away from this is not merely be like Job, because there is no one like Job. Job is not an everyman. There are ways that Job is like us, but there is also a sense in which we are not like Job at all. Of who of us would God say there was no one like him in all the earth? None of us. See, Job does not just mirror our lives. Job mirrors the life of one greater. Jesus is like us in every way. He is a real man. And yet he is also unlike us in every way, because he is God made flesh, Emmanuel. Jesus is perfectly righteous. He perfectly loved God and obeyed God and feared God and always turned away from evil. And yet the one who should be most respected was most rejected by his own friends and brothers. Jesus never had a need to offer sacrifice for his own sin. Jesus is truly a rich man, rich beyond all splendor, owns a cattle on 1,000 hills, inherits all of heaven's riches, has innumerable brothers and sisters through faith who are his, part of his family, part of his kingdom. And Jesus was a truly religious man. He was devoted to God, loved God with all of his heart, soul, mind, and strength, and fulfilled the old covenant. He didn't come just to live, but to die, offering sacrifices for not for possible sins of his own, but offering himself as the sacrifice for real sins that deserve real judgment from a real and holy God by us. The greatness of Job is only dwarfed by the greatness of Jesus. Job is not every man or every believer. Job foreshadows the greatness of the one who exceeds him. The universe needed a man who would lovingly and perfectly obey his heavenly Father in the entirety of his life, by whose obedience the many sinners would be made righteous. And Job is, in a sense, a prophet. At the heart of every prophet was the Spirit of Jesus. And Job opens and closes with God's blessing upon a righteous man. This echoes the story of the Bible. Genesis opens with the blessing of God on a righteous man named Adam, but who fails and brings disaster, and ends with God's blessing upon a better righteous man, a second Adam, Jesus Christ, who brings restoration. The life of Job should overwhelm us, highlight our own sinfulness, our own lack of integrity, and drive us to see and need and turn to one who is greater, Jesus. But there are a couple of things we can learn from Job. First, fathers, learn from Job that you have a priestly role in your family. Shepherd your children, even as adults. Ask them questions, pray for them in private, pray over them, be concerned not just for their financial portfolios, but for their spiritual life. As you worship God, men and women, worship God. Don't worship him as you see him fit, but worship as he has been revealed. Come to God rightly for praise and confession and repentance. Not through blood sacrifices that you can bring, but through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Some of you have a strong reputation among others. Some of you lack that. Maybe you're not a person of integrity or blamelessness or uprightness in your relationships. Maybe your relationships have been soiled by dishonesty and gossip or credible accusations. Seek to be a person who has a sound reputation of godly righteousness in your life. And like Job, do you treat others the way that you wish to be treated? Reaching out to those in need, the hungry, the poor, the orphan, the widow. Or do you treat them the way that you were treated? Job seems to have ordered his life in such a way that wealth, fame, and riches are not the centers of his life, but rather love for God. And I wonder if that's true for you. Or have you let all the gifts that God has given you become the objects of your greatest affections? Have you let the created blessings become the things that you worship? All good things that you have are from God, who is greater than the stuff that He gives you. And God may grant you blessings, but the ultimate blessing you have is not what is in your bank account. It is for God to call you His own. For God to say of you, you are righteous, you are upright, you are blameless, well done, good and faithful servant. You know, as ideal as the introduction of Job is, and it is a wonderful ideal, we must remember that it is not Eden. It's not perfect. You see, we, like Job, we live east of Eden. And we live east of Eden because of our sin. We live east of Eden because of judgment. And we all know what becomes of Job's riches by the end of chapter 1. Everything he owns, everything he loves, everything he treasures, everything is gone. Reminding us that life and stuff and wealth are fleeting. But what we see in the opening verses of Job is a picture of what the Bible describes as blessing in His kingdom. Peace, feasting, family, fellowship, like lying beside green pastures with a shepherd who never leaves us in want. And even as we see this in Job's life, we are reminded that this side of heaven, no gifts that are given, no riches that we gain will last forever. And so therefore, we must fix our eyes on a greater prize, on a better land. Not us, not Florida, not America. A new Eden, a new heaven, and a new earth, where what we are enamored with now is replaced by things that are so much more glorious. So let us long for our true and better homeland that is ruled by a true and better Job who intercedes for his children and even his enemies, where sacrifices are not offered weekly but once for all by Jesus Christ, who was perfectly righteous yet suffered as though he was a sinner, who was perfectly rich yet for our sake became poor, so that in becoming sin for us, we might become the righteousness of God. And so that in his poverty, we might become rich beyond compare. That is not just the story of Job. That is the story of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it's good news.